Good evening, everybody. My name is Jeremy, an alcoholic. And you weren't kidding when you said, y'all move fast. I'm used to, at least 5 or 10 minutes worth of readings before the speaker starts. So the first thing I want to do tonight is I want to thank Billy for asking me to come up here or over here. Not really sure which direction it is. But it's really an honor and a pleasure to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really mean that. And I don't mean just coming up to speak. I mean, doing the coffee, cleaning up chairs, every job that I do here is just as important as the other one. And the fact that my life has changed so that anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous would say, hey, this guy has some kind of example that this will work, is still today, still blows my mind, you know, that this program has really changed me. So I want to thank you for asking me to do this. My sobriety date is July 3rd of 2000. I have a home group, which is the Jay Walkers group in Richmond, Virginia. We meet at Bon Air Presbyterian Church on Huguenot Road, Tuesday nights at 7 for a closed big book discussion meeting, and Friday nights at 7 for an open speaker meeting. So if you're ever in Richmond on a Tuesday or Friday, we would love to have you. And that's been something that's been vital to my sobriety as a home group. And as the reading expressed, I'm supposed to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And because of that power that I found here that you described, I am not the same person that walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God for that. I am by no means any perfect example or saint or anything like that, but I can look people in the eye today and say I'm happy to be the guy that I am. And when I came to AA, all I could do was stare at the floor because I was embarrassed, I was ashamed, and I was empty inside. And what you guys showed me was a new way of life. And I'm glad that when I came here, the people that were here showed me that Alcoholics Anonymous was a lot more than just about not drinking. That I could not only be free from drinking, but I could have an entirely new life. I could be free from me. Because that's really what I was a prisoner of. Alcohol was really the medicine that I tried to take to deal with me. And I didn't realize that until after I got sober. You know, I thought alcohol was the problem, not me. So I'll start off with, the first time that I remember getting drunk was at 13 years old. I have no reason by society standards why I should be an alcoholic. I came from a great home. I came from a mother who did everything she could to give me the best she could afford. I have no relatives that I know of that are alcoholics. Alcohol was hardly ever in my home. I just had no examples or no, you know, genealogy or anything to say, hey, this guy's going to turn out to be a drunk. I just wound up being an alcoholic. And what that proves to me is that alcoholism doesn't pick favorites. It doesn't pick races. It doesn't pick financial classes. It doesn't pick anything like that. It's just, to me, it's just random, at least from my experience, because I have no good excuse. All I know is when I put alcohol in my body, something happens to me that doesn't seem to happen to other people. And I don't like to call them normal people because I have no idea what normal is. I don't even know if there's such thing as normal. But there's people that can go out after work and have a couple of beers or a couple of bourbon and cokes and go home and go to work the next day and it doesn't affect them whatsoever. Me, when I put alcohol in my body, something happens. And my first sponsor called it, when I start drinking, I get thirsty. And I knew exactly what he meant when he said that, you know, because when I put alcohol any form, it doesn't matter, wine, bourbon, you know, beer, it doesn't matter. I develop this thirst that I can't seem to quench, and I will continue to drink to quench that thirst. So at 13 years old, a buddy of mine got together with me and said, hey, there's a party across the street. A bunch of adults are having a party. They invited him and his stepdad over, and you know, they said, why don't you come with me? And I told my mom, hey, I'm going to go next door to this party. And she warned me. She said, hey, I know those neighbors, you know, like to drink. And at the time, I was raised in a religion that didn't even believe in drinking. No alcohol whatsoever. So she said, just be careful when you go over there. And I remember going to this party and sitting in the corner and watching everybody else drink and just have a good time. And it wasn't even about the drinking. It was just, I watched a room full of people that were able to just be free and enjoy themselves. They didn't care who they were, what was going on. They were just laughing and having a good time. And from as young as I can remember, I can't remember being able to do that. I can't remember being able to go in a room and just be okay that it's me. Like, I always felt like I needed to impress you, or I needed to do something, or I needed to, you know, I was never okay just being me. And I watched these people and I just thought, that's all I want. I just want the freedom to just enjoy life. And this adult came by. I still have no idea who he is today. And set a red, white Budweiser can down in front of me and said, hey, it's a party. You know, have a drink. You're sitting over here in the corner. Everybody's having a good time. You know, join the party. And I thought to myself, well, they all seem to be having a good time and it doesn't seem to be causing them any trouble. And, you know, so why not? So I grabbed it and I opened it and I started drinking it. And I'll be honest, I was 13, so I didn't like the taste of Budweiser at the time. I like Pepsi and Kool-Aid and, you know, stuff like that. Budweiser wasn't exactly what I was looking for, but I felt honored that, you know, an adult would give this to me. So I started drinking it. I finished my first one. I went to the refrigerator. I got another one. And by the time I finished that second beer, it happened. And I've heard it described in many different forms and many different ways in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the only way I can describe it is my experience, which was after that second beer, I got this nice, warm, tingly feeling. Started in my head, went all the way down to my toes. I slid back in the chair a little bit. My shoulders dropped. And I just went, you know. And for the first time in my life, my head was completely quiet. Because for me, as young as I can remember, there was always voices going on, going, well, they're looking at you and they're saying this and you need to do that and you're not wearing the right this. And it was always like 1,000 people screaming at the top of their lungs. And after that second beer, it was like being out in the desert by myself. You know what I mean? It was just pure quiet. And I went, wow, this is awesome. You know? This is amazing, and what should have probably been a warning was my thought was, wow, if two does this, I can't wait to see what three's going to do. And I went from being that shy, awkward, sitting in the corner kid to jumping in this party full of adults, playing drinking games, telling jokes, dancing around. I mean, just, I was free. And that's the best word I can think to describe what alcohol does for me. It gives me freedom. It gives me freedom from my mind. It gives me power to do things that I am incapable of doing on my own, which is why when I came to AA and you guys said alcohol was my solution, not my problem, I understood what you meant. Because how it's hard to give up a friend that does that to you when nothing else in the world will give me the freedom to do what I need to do. That's hard to give up. And so, of course, I started drinking with these adults. And next thing you knew, I was on my 12th or 13th beer, and, you know, the room starts spinning, I start falling down, and, you know, my buddy had to take me back to his house because I was getting a little out of hand, and I just remember, you know, the next couple hours being in his bathroom throwing up with the room spinning, you know, and his mom just knocking on the door asking me if I was okay. And the next morning I woke up and I felt like I'd been run over by a truck. I mean, I just, everything hurt. My hair hurt. You know, I mean, everything hurt. But all I could think was, man, I can't wait to do that again. You know, I can't wait to do that again, because I had never felt that kind of ease and comfort, as the book describes, that freedom. And for me, I consider that first drink my first spiritual experience, because I can remember everything about that night. I can't tell you what I had for lunch yesterday. You know, but I can remember where everybody was sitting and the way the room looked. And I'd only been in the house one time, and I can describe it to you today. That's the kind of impact alcohol had on me. And, of course, at 13, I didn't, you know, start drinking every single day. I mean, I drank when I could, and my drinking really kind of didn't take off till I got to high school, where I, you know, met some friends that liked to party and stuff like that. And for, you know, the first few years, drinking was really just a lot of fun. It was football games and tailgate parties and parties at people's houses while their parents were gone and, you know, just that kind of stuff. And really the only consequences were, you know, hangovers or maybe I spent a little too much money or that kind of stuff. But where the change started to occur for me is after I graduated high school, I ended up moving here to Virginia because this is where my mom is from. And all the people that I used to party with in high school started doing what I considered weird things. Like, they started getting good jobs. They started getting married. They started buying houses. They started, you know, wanting to have kids. And I'm like, what's wrong with you guys? You know, it's time to party. You know, we're free. We're out of school. And, you know, it's time to go nuts. And they were like, we kind of did that already. You know, it wasn't attractive to them. And I know why today, because alcohol didn't do the same thing that it did for them, that it does for me. So obviously I do what alcoholics do, and I find people that drink like me. I find the people that like to go out and party, and I find the people that like to drink during the week, that aren't just, you know, Friday night drinkers. They don't mind going out on a Tuesday night and staying out till 2 o'clock in the morning and getting drunk. And what started to happen was alcohol went from, you know, just being fun and being exciting to, it became more and more of a necessity. I started to realize that just to participate in the world, I needed a drink, you know. I started, pretty early on at the age of, I think it was 19 or 20 is when I took my first morning drink. Cause I had partied all night long. It had been a really long Friday night. I'd maybe slept about 2 or 3 hours, woke up the next morning, just, you know, massive hangover, and I'm trying to eat bread and drink tomato juice and ibuprofen and, you know, all this stuff that's supposed to cure a hangover, which I don't even know if technically it was a hangover. I was probably still half drunk, but I remember my friend saying, well, why don't you just go to the fridge and get a beer? And I was like, man, are you kidding me? It's like 9 o'clock in the morning. Why would I want to do that? And he's like, I'm telling you, man, if you just go drink a beer, you're going to feel a whole lot better. And I said, I don't know that I can do that. And he said, well, here, I'll bet you $20. If you drink a beer and you don't feel better, I'll give you $20. And I thought, well, that's a pretty fair deal, because even if I don't feel better, now I got $20, right? So I go to the fridge and I get a beer, and I manage to, like, choke it down. And amazingly enough, after that first beer, I felt awesome. I felt so good that I thought I'd just go to the fridge and get one more beer to really cure that hangover, you know. And then next thing you know, I'm driving up to the store and I'm getting a case for tonight. And by noon, I'm staggering drunk. And people are starting to look at me. And these are people that I partied with pretty hard. And they're, you know, looking at their watches like, man, it's only 12 o'clock and you're already, like, stumbling around and slurring your words. And, you know, and I did the typical, well, this is my life and it's my day off. And who are you to judge me? And that kind of stuff. And so that was, you know, the first time I got drunk in the morning. Which also turns out to be my first blackout. I won't say the first blackout I remember. I'll say the first lapse of time I don't remember. Because at about 12:30, I went into the use their bathroom and I shut the door. And then next thing you know, I hear somebody knocking on the door. And I open my eyes and I'm laying on the floor and I'm looking at the ceiling. And I did what became pretty common for me, was to go, what am I doing on the floor and where am I? And so I got up and I opened the door. And they said, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. Why wouldn't I be? They're like, you've been in here for a long time. And I'm like, well, what time is it? And they're like, it's 8 o'clock. I went into this bathroom at 12:30. And it ain't much bigger than that bathroom right there, other than it had a tub, you know? And my first thought probably should have been, oh, my God, you almost lost 8 hours of your life in a bathroom. So, you know, something's not right about that. But it wasn't. My first thought was, man, all that drinking I did is wasted now, and I got to start all over again. And that's what I did. I went down to the fridge, and I opened that case that I bought, and I started drinking out of it, and they looked at me like I had two heads. You know, like, what is wrong with this guy? And but I didn't think anything of it. So, you know, after that point, a drink in the morning was no big deal, because I realized how much it was going to make me feel better. So then my drinking started getting to the point where these people that I used to drink pretty hard with were starting to say things like, you know what, Jeremy, you're a lot of fun, but can't you just ever show up and, you know, not be drunk? I mean, can't you just come and have a few? Why do you always have to be drunk? And I thought, well, what kind of stupid question is that? You know, I mean, when it does what it's doing for me, why wouldn't you be? So then what I either have to do is I have to start getting rid of those friends because they don't understand me, or they don't like me for who I am. That was my favorite one. Well, if you don't like me for who I am, then I'll go somewhere else. Or I start hiding it from you, which is what I started to do. You know, one of the ones that still today, and I share it a lot because it just is burnt into my head, is these particular friends came to me one day and said, "Hey, we're having our daughter's birthday party here today. She was turning 8 years old, and her grandfather's coming, and he's a minister in the church, and all our other family's coming in and stuff. So we'd really appreciate it if you didn't drink while they're here. After the party's over, we'll bust out some beers, we'll have a good time, but just don't drink while they're here." And I never thought that that was odd, that they're asking me, please don't drink during my 8-year-old daughter's birthday party. I mean, the fact that they even had to ask me that probably should have said, hey, something's wrong. And I thought to myself, well, that doesn't really seem like a big deal. I don't see why I couldn't do that for you. So the party starts, and it's about an hour into the party. And I look, and everybody's drinking Sprite and ginger ale. And I think to myself, you know, I could probably go to the store and get like 2 12-packs of Zima. If anybody remembers what that was, it was like a wine cooler, but it was clear like Sprite. And I could get 2 12-packs of that, and I could drink that, and then nobody would know I was drinking. And that's exactly what I did. I went to the store, I bought 2 12-packs, I left them in the car, I would lean in the car window and fill my drink up and come back to the party. And about halfway through the party, of course, I'm starting to slur my words and I'm starting to stagger a little bit, and I start getting that look. You know, which, if you're like me, I had a lot. Which was, oh, come on, really? You're drinking again? Like, we asked you not to do this. And they didn't even say a word. I just know everything that's coming out of their mind by that look. Like, you couldn't just make it through a couple of hours. You had to do this, didn't you? And that look of disappointment and disgust, you know. So after, you know, a year or so of, you know, hanging out with these good friends of mine, it gets to the point where one day his wife, because we were supposed to just go to the store and get some cigarettes, and we disappeared for 3 or 4 hours and came back drunk, and she took my drink out of my hand, threw it in my face, said, you know what, get off my property. If you ever come back, I'm calling the cops. You know, and these are my friends. And they're finally starting to say, you know, we've kind of had enough, you know. So, of course, fine. I'm not going to be your friend, you know. I'll go find other people that understand me. And it gets to the point where drinking is now just a necessity. It is no longer, sure, there's moments of fun in between, but it really is more about, I just need a drink to survive. I need a drink to get through the day. I need a drink to stop my skin from crawling. I remember, you know, towards the end of my drinking, my hands starting to shake just a little bit and going, God, look at all the stress I'm under. You know, when I got sober, I was 23 and I was living at my mom's house and I wasn't even able to pay her the rent that I owed her. Look at all the stress that I'm under with life. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. But that's the delusion that I lived under. And that's one thing I love is that this talks about delusion, not denial. Denial means I know the truth and I don't want to admit it. Delusion means I really believe the lie. I believe that my drinking is not abnormal. I could take a lie detector test and tell you that I'm just going through a rough time, you know, that it's really not that bad. And that's what I believe. Hey, it's just, you know, I'm just young and I do goofy stuff and it's going to get better. As a result of my drinking, I did end up getting one DUI. Why I don't have thousands, I'm just lucky. I mean, I really am just lucky. I am not a good drunk driver. I thought I was, but that's probably because I drove more drunk than I drove sober. I mean, that's just the reality, and the fact that I didn't get pulled over way more, it just blows my mind. But I did get pulled over. Obviously, I failed the sobriety test, and it's still today I look at it when I got pulled over. I was just leaving my friend's house to go pick up a buddy to go out and drink, and I blew a .17. So I was over twice the legal limit, and I was just leaving to go out to drink. You know, so I can't even imagine the nights that I was driving out there, how intoxicated I really was. And the fact that I didn't hurt anybody to this day is I'm extremely grateful for, because I know I could have really hurt somebody, because I started blacking out when I drove, too. There were nights I don't even remember getting in the car, and I would drive 45 minutes from Richmond to Amelia, where I lived, and not remember the trip at all. And just, you know, walk out and go, thank God the car's here. You know, I don't see any dents in it. Must be all right, you know. And not thinking that that was odd. So like I said, I did get pulled over that night for a DUI. Spent the night in Chesterfield County. And, you know, the next morning when I got out, my thought was, man, I need a drink to figure out what I'm going to do. You know, it wasn't, man, you just got pulled over and you could have killed somebody. It was, I need a drink. I went to Food Lion in the morning to figure out what I'm going to do. And I ended up having to go to court, and it's just a flat out, you got pulled over, you blew, you failed. Judge says, how do you plead? I say, no contest. You know, I'll accept the punishment, but I'm not admitting guilt. Even though it's, I mean, there's no doubt about it. You got busted drinking and driving, and I couldn't just say, yeah, I'm guilty. I plead no contest. And I remember going to ASAP at the time, and the counselor said, well, first thing what we need to do is we need to do an evaluation on you just to kind of see where you're at, what course of action we need to take. So could you take this little questionnaire in the other room, fill it out. When you're done, bring it in, and we'll go over your answers and kind of decide what action we need to take. And I said, okay. So I sit down, and I'm looking, and it's all questions about my drinking. So I get this bright idea that, you know what, I'm just, whatever I would normally answer, I'll just go ahead and cut it in half. You know, I'll just cut the answer in half. That way they'll be like, hey, this is just a young guy. He just did something stupid. We'll rush him through the program, get him out of the way so we can help the real drunks, you know, that kind of stuff. So I went through and I answered all the questions and I cut my answers in half. And I went and I sat down with her, and she looked over and she said, okay, Jeremy, based on the answers you've given me, you appear to be an extreme case. And, yeah, you know, you appear to be an extreme case, and you're going to need extra classes and extra counseling. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, I just lied and cut my answers in half, and I'm an extreme case. And so as a result, they sent me to, you know, all these different classes, and they did send me to Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of that, I was 21 at the time. And at the time, you didn't have to get your sheet signed. It just said, what meeting did you go to and what was the topic? And I did go to the first one or two meetings. At the time, I was living in Amelia, so my first meeting was on a Wednesday night in Farmville. I think it was at a Catholic church. And to me, it was really weird, and it felt kind of like the mafia, because it was nighttime, and you had to drive around the back parking lot, and then there was, like, steps that went into the basement with, like, one light on the side. You know, and you go into this, like, fellowship hall kind, and there's, like, this haze of smoke. And, I mean, I was 21, and the next youngest guy to me was probably 35. And I was just, like, looking around going, what in the world did they send me here for? You know? And I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to their stories, and all I hear is, because of alcohol, I lost my kids, I lost my house, I lost my job, I lost my dog. I mean, I lost everything. And, you know, hey, we don't have to do that anymore, but here's all the things that I lost. And that's what I heard. I don't think that that's what they were saying. That's just what I heard. And my thought was, well, I'm 21 and I haven't lost anything. So this really isn't the place for me. And those people did exactly what they were supposed to do. They came and they talked to me. They gave me their phone numbers. They made me feel welcome. And I know they were talking about their drinking. And had I listened to their drinking, I probably would have related. But obviously, I just wasn't desperate enough. And I went to one or two of those meetings, and I just thought, I'm wasting their time. They're wasting my time. I'm just not going to go back. And so I would just fill my sheet out. So I went to this meeting, and the topic was sobriety. You know, and I didn't go back. And, you know, but the next couple of years, my drinking just went from like 0 to 1,000. I mean, it took off. And what's funny is during that time when I was going to those classes and stuff, the counselors and stuff told me that for a year you are on probation. Like, you are not allowed to do anything. No drugs, no alcohol, no nothing. If we test you and you show up positive, you go to jail. And we can show up at your house at any time. And it doesn't matter. You're not allowed to drink. And I remember leaving that session with her. And by the time I got to the parking lot, my mind had already said, well, you know what? You took my license away and you took all this other stuff away. So you're not taking the drinking away too. So you know what? I'll still drink, but I'll do all the rest of your stuff. And how I didn't get caught during that time, I have no idea. But that's the deal I made with myself. And I remember this one night in particular that I'll share, because for me, it just shows that you can't scare an alcoholic into being sober. You just can't. You couldn't for me anyway. And that was during this probationary period. I went with my sister at the time to the Richmond Coliseum when the Richmond Renegades were playing, the hockey team. And I remember just going, and, you know, I drank quite a bit before I got there. But I remember getting to the Coliseum, and if you've ever been there, if you want to drink booze, you got to go to a little table and show them your ID, and they give you like a wristband so that the people at the concession stands know who you're holding up to drink. Well, at the time, I had a restricted driver's license with this big giant red R on it, you know, and I remember going up to the table and saying, I'd like a wristband, and I put my ID on the table, and the guy looked at it, and he said, I can't give you a wristband. I'm like, well, why can't you give me a wristband? I'm over 21. And he's like, because I'm a Richmond City cop, and I know what this red R means, and if I catch you drinking here tonight, you go to jail. And I was like, oh, well, yes, sir, that was a bad mistake on my part. And I, you know what, thank you, I appreciate your tolerance. And I put my license back in my wallet, and I started walking away, and I got probably about 30 seconds away from that table, and the next thought was, I'll bet you there's another table on the other side. And I went around the Coliseum on the other side, and there was two older ladies who were checking IDs, and I put my thumb over the R, and I showed it to them, and they gave me a wristband, and I started drinking. And I mean, for me, that's just proof that I don't have a choice. You know, it's not about, because for until I got to AA, I couldn't understand why I did that and why I would hurt the people that I hurt and why the people that I loved, I kept doing that kind of stuff to, and why when I didn't want to drink, I always drank. And I never really realized that I didn't have a choice, that I had to have it. I needed it. I needed that relief, and I couldn't explain that to you. I just knew that even though he just threatened me, he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand why I need this, you know. So obviously my drinking just got to the point where the last 8 or 9 months of my drinking, I thought about suicide every single day. Every single day. Because death didn't scare me at this point. What scared me is, oh my God, I'm going to live 50 more years like this. Because most of my friends had gone. My family was barely putting up with me. Why? I don't even know. I mean, I put them through so much hell, it's ridiculous. You know, the disappearing, coming in rages, them waiting for the, you know, police to call to tell them if I'm alive or not. You know, I mean, just all the stealing from them. I mean, just all the things that I put them through. And all I could think was, man, I want to get this over with. And for me, I love that when I came to AA, you didn't tell me there's a checklist of things that you need to accomplish before you're considered an alcoholic. You know, like you need to have 60 UIs and you need to have 2 ex-wives and you need to have, you know, whatever the case was. Because on the outside, my life could have got a whole lot worse. I mean, at the time, I still had a job. I don't know why, but I still did. I still had a place to live and I had a hot meal to eat. So it could have got a lot worse outside, but where it was inside is where it describes, and I think it's, I can't remember what chapter it's in, but it talks about he will find a loneliness such as few men know. And that's where I reached for me, that no matter, I could be in a room full of people and feel like I was absolutely alone and that nobody understood what I was going through. And, you know, I would lay at night, and the place that it came to for me was I would lay in bed at night and look up at the ceiling and beg God to kill me in my sleep. You know, please just let me close my eyes and not wake up. The world is going to be a better place if I'm not here, you know, and I would wake up the next morning and I would be disappointed that I was still alive. You know, I mean, that is a pain I do not wish on my worst enemy today, you know, to look around and go, God, I'm still breathing, you know, and it was like that for 7 or 8 months at the end of my drinking. And what finally happened is I tried a bunch of different ways to quit. I couldn't ever seem to stay sober. A week was the longest I remember making it, and I threw myself a party after that week because, look, I made it a week. I'm not a drunk, you know. And so what had happened is I'd finally gone to my family. I got 100% honest with everything I was doing. Here's all the things that I'm doing. I haven't paid for my truck. I haven't paid insurance. I'm spending money on booze and all kinds of extracurricular activities. And, you know, I'm running the streets. I'm doing all kinds of crazy stuff. I really don't want to do this anymore, and I meant it with everything in me. And my mother went out, which I was a grown man at the time, so she didn't have to. She maxed out her credit cards, cashed in her overtime, emptied her savings, and paid off everything that I owed. And 3 days later, I was drunk again. And I couldn't explain it. And I felt like the worst person in the world. I drank for 3 days on that bench. Because all I could think was, God, I finally got honest, and I really meant it with everything in me, and I did it again. Why? Why can I not do this? Why am I such a bad person, you know? And I came back from that 3-day bender, and obviously my family knew what I did, and they were waiting for me in the living room at my mom's house, because it wasn't my house. And it was my family, my boss, and one or two friends that were still willing to put up with me. And this is how arrogant I am. I walk in the door and see them all sitting there and go, how dare she? After everything she's just done for me, how dare she do this to me? Now all these people think I got a problem. You know what I mean? You know, if you knew me for 5 minutes at this point, you knew I had a problem. I mean, there was no doubt about it. But that's how delusional I am, that I still think, even at that moment, that maybe I could even pull it together. And they sat me down and they spent the next like 2 hours saying things like, we love you, we care about you, you're sick, you need help. And the one thing that is just burnt into my mind, and I hope it always stays there, is my mom looking me in the eyes with tears rolling down her face, which wasn't new. I'd made her cry, I'm sure, plenty of times before. But she looked me in the eyes and said, you know, we're tired of watching you die. And basically what they said to me at that point was, either you do something or you need to go, because we can't watch you die anymore. We just can't watch you kill yourself. And I don't know where it came from. I mean, I know today. At the time, I didn't know. I just got this one clear thought that was, you know what, Jeremy, if you drink again, you're probably going to die. And I didn't know what that was going to look like, whether it was going to be 50 years from now or whether I was going to go out into the woods with a gun. I didn't know. All I knew was it was clear, and that's the first time I'd ever felt that way, that there wasn't a solution this time, or some trick or some scheme or some way to get around this. And for some reason, even after 7 months of wanting to die, that night I didn't want to die. And they said, will you get some help? And the only reason I said yes is because I was out of ideas. And they put me in the car and they took me to Chippenham Hospital, which has a detox called Tucker's. And I laid in the hospital that night looking at the ceiling, shaking and sweating and crying and going, why? Why me? You know, why, God? You know, I'm a nice guy. You know, I didn't want to be like this. When I was in elementary school and they said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And everybody's like a fireman and an astronaut. I wasn't like, I want to be an alcoholic. You know, I mean, it wasn't what I had planned for my life. But I do remember looking up at the ceiling going, you know what, if there is a God, if there's something out there, I need help. I mean, I really need help. And I don't know where that came from. I mean, maybe it's just that moment of desperation. You know, because I had prayed to God before, but it was usually what I call my guess what prayers. Guess what? I'm so drunk, I think I'm going to die. Get me out of this one. Or I spent my whole paycheck. I need money. Help me with this one. You know, it was always, I'll do this if you do that. It was always some kind of bargain. It was never just help. So the next day I woke up, and I can't even remember what we did. I think we watched some videos or something. And they let you smoke in the hospital at the time, which was amazing. That probably helped me get through it. But that night, members of Alcoholics Anonymous came in to bring a meeting in. And I remember the nurses saying, hey, come on, guys, we're meeting in this room. They're having a meeting. And I went, meeting? What are they talking about? And I saw them come in with this green binder that said AA, that had like a couple readings and stuff. And my first thought, honestly, was, oh, man, really? AA? I mean, I know I'm in here because I can't stop drinking and my life's a shambles, but I'm not an alcoholic, you know? I mean, this is ridiculous. It's all my other problems that make me drink, you know? Then they said, well, you don't have to go, but if you don't go to the meeting, you got to sit in your room and you can't do anything else. We're turning the TV off or unplugging the phone. So you either sit in your room or you go in there. And I was like, all right, I'll go in there. And I went and I waited for what had happened every other time, which was somebody shaking their finger at me and going, Jeremy, let's talk about your drinking. And let's talk about how you're drinking certain other people. And you're drinking and you're drinking and you're drinking. And they didn't do that at all. They sat down and they said that they were alcoholics. And they started talking about their drinking. They talked about the way they drink and the way they felt and the way that when they wanted to stop, they couldn't. And the people that they had hurt and the emptiness inside and that wanting to die. And I was like, holy cow. Man, they sound just like me. I was like, have they been following me around or something, you know? And there was four different people that came in from AA that night, and they were different ages, different races, and different sexes. And they all told the same story. Instead of the house and the wife and the kids and all that, this time I heard, when I start drinking, I can't stop. And no matter how bad it gets, I always start drinking again. And I understood that. Except they said, today, we don't have to drink anymore. We don't have to live like that. We're sober and happy. And I went, right. Sober and happy at the same time? No way. And it's just like oil and water. Those two don't mix together, you know. But what was weird is only after an hour, these complete strangers, I believed what they were saying. I trusted them, which was weird because people had tried to help me all along and I never trusted them or believed in them. And that was July 3rd, which is my sobriety date. And the very next night on 4th of July, four more people from AA came up there and talked to us again. And we all looked around like, what are y'all doing here? Like, what do you mean? I'm like, it's 4th of July. Shouldn't you be out watching fireworks with your families and stuff like that? Why are you here? Because we're still alcoholics on 4th of July. Just because it's a holiday don't mean we're not alcoholics anymore. You know, and I mean, I couldn't comprehend that they're giving up time away from their families to come talk to us, total strangers. But that also really impressed me because they said, this is what we do to stay sober. And one holiday is not that big a deal compared to the life we've been given. And there was a lady in that meeting that night. Her name was, now it's totally gone. Holy cow, I can't believe that. Anyway, she gave me a meeting schedule. And she circled a bunch of meetings. And she said, when you get out, why don't you come to some of these meetings? She's like, you can sit in the back. You don't have to say you're an alcoholic. You don't have to put a dollar in the basket. All you have to do is come and listen. And if you keep hearing your story over and over again, then maybe we have a solution for you. And maybe you can try what we're doing. And so she gave me that meeting schedule. And when I got out, the first meeting I went to was Jaywalkers, which is my home group now. And man, that meeting's got a special place for me. And it felt like my sponsor says today, it felt like the worst day of my life. God, not only is my life a shambles and I just got out of detox, but now I'm going to AA. You know, I mean, it was like one more stamp on you're a real loser now because you're going to AA of your own free will this time because I wasn't court ordered or anything like that, you know. But those people gave me just enough hope to get me there. So you know what? I know they're crazy. I can't really believe they're that happy without taking something, you know. But for some reason, they seem to have something that I can't understand. And I went to that meeting, and I sat in the back, and I didn't put a dollar in the basket because I didn't have one, but I wasn't putting one in there, and I didn't say I was an alcoholic. But what I heard was a whole room full of people just like me. They told the same story. The only difference was I looked at those people, and I couldn't believe they were the same people because they were different. There was something different about them. I believed their story, and I believed what they said was real, but I couldn't see them being capable of that. And to me, that's where the hope in Alcoholics Anonymous came. Not somebody just sitting in a meeting looking like me saying I didn't drink today. It was somebody who said, I had the life you have, but I don't resemble that at all. I mean, that's true change. And I remember going, hey, maybe there's something here. And I started coming back to a couple of meetings. And one of the things that they said is, hey, if you want to stay sober, you probably need to get a sponsor. And I had no idea what a sponsor was. I just thought it was somebody that if you're sitting at a bar with a drink in your hand, you're getting ready to drink, you call him and he drives up and, you know, like smacks it out of your hand and, you know, throws you over his shoulder and takes you back to his house and gives you milk and cookies and pats you on the head and, you know, whatever. I mean, if that's what it takes to help a drunk, I'll do it if that's what it really takes. But I had no idea what it meant. All they kept saying is if you don't get one, there's a good chance you're probably going to drink. And I was sitting in this meeting one day, and they said, if anybody wants a temporary sponsor, see these people that raise their hand. And I was like, oh, yeah, temporary sponsor. I like that, temporary. And I saw this guy raise his hand. I'd never talked to him personally, but I'd seen him everywhere I went. He was there. He was like, he's just at every meeting I went to. He was always there. And at the end of the meeting, this little voice in the back of my head said, you need to get up and go ask that man for help. And to me, that's when I believe I really took the first step, that I went to a complete stranger and said, I can't do this. I need help. I didn't know that's what I was doing because I didn't trust you and I wasn't doing anything you said. But for me to do that, something had to change. And I went up to this guy after the meeting and I tapped him on the shoulder and I said, excuse me, sir. I kind of sort of think I maybe need a temporary sponsor, you know, and he said, oh, you do you? And I said, yes, would you be my temporary sponsor? And he said, well, the only thing that'll make it temporary is if you don't do what I ask you to do. And I was like, oh, whoa, that's not quite the answer I expected. And he said, well, do you want temporary sobriety? I was like, well, I mean, of course not. He's like, all right, well, if you're asking, I'll be your sponsor. I'm like, okay. And he said, do you have a big book? I said, no, I don't. He said, they're over here on the literature table. They're $6. Do you have $6? I said, no, I don't have $6. He went over there and he got me this book. And he gave it to me and he said, here, when you get $6, you can pay us back. And I don't, I always choke up at this point. I don't bring this book with me to wave it around and quote out of it or anything like that. I bring it to me because the guy that gave me this book helped save my life. I mean, I had no idea that day my life was going to change. He gave me that book, he took me outside, he looked me in the eyes and he said, are you done? And I knew exactly what he meant. And that's always what I ask guys today, are you done? Because if they go, done, what do you mean, done with what? What? I'm like, all right, obviously not. You know, I mean, because I knew exactly what he meant. I said, yeah, I'm done. He said, all right, next question is, are you willing to do anything that I ask you to do if I tell you to keep you sober? And if I'd have known what was coming out of his mouth after that, I might have said no. You know? But I knew I didn't want to drink, so I was like, yeah, sure. And, okay. And he said, all right, well, if I'm going to sponsor you, here's what we're going to do. He said, you're going to start calling me every day. He said, we're going to meet once a week, and we're going to go through this book, and we're going to do the steps. When you've done the steps, you're going to share this with somebody else. You're going to get a home group. You're going to get a job in that home group. You're going to start going to 4 committed meetings a week. You're going to start going to 1 meeting a week that I go to. You're going to start blah, blah, blah. You're going to start dressing nicer. I don't want you going to meetings like you're going to a barbecue. And I mean, he just started going off on all this stuff, and I was like, oh, my God, man. You know, this guy's crazy. And he got done with this whole list of stuff, and he said, do you think you can do that? And out of my mouth went, okay. And it's not what was in my head. What was in my head was, no way, dude. There's only requirement for membership. Deserve to stop drinking. You know, that's what was going. That's what was going through my head, you know. But he is exactly what I needed. And he could have been any member of Alcoholics Anonymous that day. But God put in my path the guy I needed. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. I was not able to manipulate him or lie to him or sneak around. You know, I remember when I was hesitating on my 4-step, he always worked like different jobs and different hours. So I'd try and call him at home because I was avoiding him because I wasn't doing my 4-step. And he'd answer the phone. Like, oh, crap. Hey, I'm just checking in. You know, I mean, he's exactly who God put in my path, who I needed. And that man changed my life because he did. He sat down, we went through the book, and we did the steps. And I gained that relationship to that power that we talked about at the beginning of the meeting, that's what this is about. That I thought coming to Alcoholics Anonymous was about just stopping drinking. And don't get me wrong, if I'm still drinking, there ain't much hope for me. But this book and those steps gave me access to that power that I found here. And I know it's different for everybody, and that's the miraculous thing here, is that I don't have to put a specific name or a specific face on it, but I know it exists, because after I started doing what he asked me to do, things just started to happen that were no longer a coincidence. You know, I wanted to try and blame it on that. It's just a coincidence, you know, but it just kept happening over and over again. You know, it's kind of like there's no other explanation than something starting to work in my life, and you know, the first higher power that I started to believe in was just that feeling I got when I came to a meeting. Because my sponsor said, it's got to be a power bigger than you. And it can't be a doorknob. It can't be a light bulb, you know, because you've got power over that stuff. It's got to be something bigger than you that you can't control. And when I came to a meeting, no matter how I felt or what was going on, I always felt better when I left. Every single time. So for me to come in and even not do anything, and feel better when I leave, there's a power working in my life. And that's what I started to believe in. And, you know, as a result of that, at a year sober, I started carrying meetings back into that detox that I was a patient at. And for 2 years, I started carrying it in with that woman that had carried it to me. And then after a couple of years, I became chairman for the treatment committee, which is in charge of taking meetings into that facility. So I went from a patient to the chairman of the committee responsible for that. I mean, there's no other explanation for me than that there's some kind of God or power working in my life. I've got the opportunity to do ridiculous amounts of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I've done probably 7 different positions in my district, including DCM, which was an absolute honor. I was told that, you know, if I'm going to be helpful here, I need to do stuff. I need to do more than come and just take a seat in a meeting. You know, and that's why when I mentioned my home group was so important, because I was taught that my home group is not just a place that I get to come and feel warm and fuzzy. You know, that it's a place that I come and have a responsibility in to make sure there's a place to bring a drunk. You know, so that when somebody's looking for a place, I know if I send them to my home group, they're going to get the message that they need to hear. And to be a part of that, you know, my first job in my home group was coffee cleanup, you know, and then I moved to coffee maker, and I thought that was the greatest thing in the world, and I way overdid it. I had like 8 different kinds of creamer and, you know, all this stuff set up, and then a couple people nudged me and said, hey, maybe the Irish cream and amaretto flavors aren't the best to have at the meeting, you know. I was like, sorry, I didn't drink anything like that, so I didn't realize, you know. And then at like 9 months sober, my home group said, you know, we're looking for a new treasurer. We'd like Jeremy to be the treasurer. And I said, ha ha, I can't. Requirement's 1 year. You guys require 1 year. I can't be the treasurer. And they said, yeah, we trust you. you're our new treasurer. And that's the kind of stuff that started happening, that people started to trust me because I started to do things that were out of my nature, like actually show up when I said I was going to show up, you know, do what I say I'm going to do, be there on time. Stuff that I didn't realize was a spiritual way of life. Because when they told me this is a spiritual way of life, I thought, so am I going to have to like shave my head and go onto a mountaintop and hand out flowers at the airport? Or, you know, I mean, what exactly? I had no idea what that meant. And I didn't realize that just doing those simple things, being of use when I don't feel like it, showing up on time, helping others when they need it, things like that were just living a spiritual way of life. And my life just continued to get better. And it doesn't mean that in my sobriety things haven't happened that haven't been rough to go through. Because I don't believe that just because we come here and we try to live this way of life that nothing bad will ever happen to me. You know, I mean, that just hasn't been my experience. But I also believe, too, that the power that I found here is there for me no matter what is going on in my life, and that is there to get me through it, not to... Because the power I used to believe in was a God that would go, here, deal with that and see what happens. You know, almost like an ant farm or something. You know, just like, let's turn up the heat and see what happens. You know, that's the kind of power I believed in. Instead of today, I just believe that stuff happens in my life. But God is there to say, hey, regardless of what's going on, I'll help you get through this. And so far, anything that I faced in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to get through sober. And I have the pleasure of meeting lots of other people in this program that have been down the path before me that have shown me that too. And the wonderful privilege, I was listening to, you know, Tom I in the car on the way up here, and he's, whatever, 54 years sober now, something like that, you know, and realizing that this is definitely a way of life, and I don't ever have to drink again. I mean, I don't, that's a promise. You know, as long as I do this, my life can change, and God has made me useful in ways that I just wasn't useful before. You know, as part of my amends to my family, God has found all kinds of neat ways to make me useful. You know, one of the first ones that I remember that I love was I was probably about 2 years sober. Maybe I was probably 3 years sober because I just finally moved out of Mom's house, which was awesome. My sponsor's like, it's time to get out and go find you somewhere to live. And, I had done some extra work on the side, and which I didn't have time to do, and I made an extra $300, and I put it in the bank Monday morning. And Monday afternoon, my mom called me and said, hey, I was just wondering, your sister's got in some financial troubles, and we were just kind of wondering if maybe she could borrow some money. And first of all, the fact that my mother called me looking for money was a miracle, you know, because I never had money. So the fact that she would even think I had money is a testament for what Alcoholics Anonymous did in my life. I said, well, you know, I don't have a whole lot of money, but if I can help, I'll help. How much does she need to borrow? And she's like, she needs $300, you know, and I just put that in at noon. And it was one of those moments where I just knew, and I just said, all right, does she need a cashier check? You know, does she need cashier check? What does she need? And I found that the more that I seem to put into this world, the more that keeps coming back to me. And I have, a friend of mine says that in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am way overpaid. I really am. For the amount of work that I've put into Alcoholics Anonymous, what I've gotten out of it is ridiculously unbalanced. I mean, it really is, because my life is so much better than I feel like I deserve sometimes. But one thing that I love about it is not that AA's turned me rich or famous or anything like that. I mean, there's nothing special about my life on the outside. What it's done for me is it's allowed me to become the things I didn't know I was capable of, like a son, a brother, a father, a husband. I was incapable of any of those things before I got here. I couldn't be present for you. Because I was so concerned about me and how's this going to affect me and what's this going to do for me and what am I going to look like on the end of this? And I'm not saying that I ain't selfish as all get out some days in this program. But it has allowed me to participate in my family's life in ways that I know I am incapable of on my own. And examples of that are when my son was born, a lot of you know I have a son who's 7. When he was born, he was in intensive care for a month, and we didn't know if he was going to live. It was one of the scariest times of my sobriety. I mean, it scared me way more than anything I'd ever experienced drinking. You know, when you're laying there and you have no power over whether your kid lives or not, that's a moment of faith right there. But what happened was God allowed me to be useful to my wife because I knew what I was feeling was nowhere compared to what she was going through. Because obviously mothers have an attachment to their kids that's totally different than what fathers do. Not saying that fathers don't love their kids. And I was able to, for the most part, put my fears and my stress aside and be there for her. And I know I'm not capable of that. You know, and one reason was because my sponsor would say things like, you know what, you need to get to your home group. You've been sitting at the hospital all day. Oh, but what if something happens? And he's like, they got nurses and they got doctors. He'll be all right. You need to go get right so that you can be useful. Because if you're not useful, then you're a waste anyway. You know, if you can't center yourself so that you can be useful to them, then what good are you up there? And he was absolutely right. And the people in AA stepped up and they brought us meals and they brought us meetings. And I mean, they really took care of us. And, you know, today he's 7 years old and he's honestly healthier than I think he should be sometimes. And he's very strong willed. And, but you know, it was one of those moments where I can't prove any other explanation than God got me through that. And it was only because of my connection to you guys, because that's where I'm at my best. When I'm with you, that's where my connection to God is the strongest. I can't do this on my own. As much as I love my relationship with God, I can't go out there by myself and keep that connection. I just can't. It is always strengthened and is always enhanced when I'm with you. One of the things recently, I'll share this and I'll shut up, is that, you know, one thing I was always promised is when I make that third step agreement with God, it talks about God's the keystone of that arch. And the way I look at that is that keystone holds up that arch and all the stress and responsibility of that is there. So when I make that third step with God that you can have my life and my will, he says, as long as you do my work, I will take care of whatever you need. You know, that is his responsibility. And I had an experience recently where my stepdaughter has been diagnosed with a lifelong illness, which may, for her at 23 years old, result in a colostomy bag. And she was having, obviously, financial troubles and stuff and said, I'd really like to move back home. And we said, well, we've got a spare room, but we don't even have any furniture for you. You know, what are we going to do? Well, you know what? We'll figure it out because I've been taught that I'm there to be useful. And as soon as we made the decision to move her back in, all of a sudden we get a letter in the mail from Wells Fargo. And we had bought like a home insurance policy through them. And it's a letter that says, hey, we know you bought this policy and we feel like that it wasn't represented the way it should be. So just out of gratitude for keeping this policy, we want to give you all the money back that you've paid so far, which was $1,200. What? A bank just sent me a check for $1,200 for being a good customer? That doesn't make any sense. And it was exactly what we needed to buy all the furniture and get her room set up. My wife even took it to the bank and said, hey, can you check this out? This doesn't seem legit. You know, and it was absolutely legit. I don't always want to use God's presence as a money thing because he's done way more in different areas than just that. But that's just a clear-cut example of when I need something in my life. As long as I try to come here and be useful and try to be the best that I can be, not perfect, because I can be a jerk a lot of times and I have to make amends to my family on a regular basis. But if I try to do this the best that I can, God will always honor his end of the deal, that he will take care of whatever I need. And it's been a miraculous life that I've had, and I hope one that I never take for granted, because I've watched a lot of my friends leave Alcoholics Anonymous because they're so grateful for everything they've given. I need to go out and participate in that now. Thanks, AA, but I need to enjoy all this stuff now. And a lot of them aren't here anymore. Not just in AA, but not alive. And I hope that I always remember that what I have today is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. That I owe everything to AA today. And I mean everything. And I hope I always remember that. Because it's a life way better than I deserve. And it's here for everybody that wants it. And that's what I love, is that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't pick favorites either. If you're an alcoholic, it'll work. You know, it really will. You may not understand it at first, and you may not like it. And there's days today at 14 years sober that I don't like doing it sometimes. But I also know that I have no other option. And I know that for what I put into this, I get way more out of it every single time. And I'm just honored to even be part of Alcoholics Anonymous, much less be asked to come up here and share my story. So I hope if you're new, please give this thing a shot, because you're going to be amazed at what can happen in your life. Just not drinking is just a drop in the bucket of what can happen, at least from my experience. So thanks.